We're off, and this is the 23rd of July, 1986. And this is an interview with Brigadier General G.M. McGregor. And my name is Rick Hilbert. I think to begin, Mr. McGregor, could you perhaps give us a little bit of background on your family as far as prior military experience, either with your father or perhaps brothers, and perhaps what prompted you to join Al-Qaeda in the Army?
Yeah. My family really has no background in the military, except that my grandfather served in the Canadian Forces in the Boer War, and my father served in the Canadian Forces in World War I, only strictly on a wartime basis. Both my mother and father were school teachers, my father retiring as principal of a high school in Calgary. So my only connection with the military is I happen to come of the appropriate age while World War II was on. And of course it took a lot of our interest and a lot of our activities and so on. We were very conscious of it.
Mm-hmm. What prompted you to join the Army as opposed to, we'll say, for instance, the Air Force or the Navy?
Well, as a matter of fact, I tried to join the Navy with two of my friends, but I was underage, and my father, who wanted me to go to university, decided to blow the whistle on me, and I was kicked out of HMCS Tecumseh in Calgary after about 7 days, and I went up to university. While I was at university, I became of age, and at that time, of course, I was in the University of Alberta COTC,
which is the Canadian
Officers Training Corps, and it was an Army-based organization. Mm-hmm. We were trained as potential Army officers.
Would that be a similar organization? Compared with today's ROTP?
No, it wasn't. It was based in the university, mm-hmm. and it involved drills and parades 3 times a week. It involved some study of military tactics, and it was altogether rather more intensive than the present ROTP program at the universities. Mm-hmm. The present program is totally intensive during the summer when the student leaves university, he goes to one of the military bases,
right.
and trains intensively all the time. So by and large, the present ROTP graduate, when he gets out of university, has better military knowledge than they had in my day.
Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, you were at the University of Alberta training with the COTC in 1942. You were a Lance Corporal studying engineering. Was this by choice, or were you merely placed in engineering?
No, I chose to take civil engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And the first year of engineering at the University of Alberta is common to all engineering degrees.
Mm-hmm.
I was a Lance Corporal because prior to going to the University of Alberta, I had joined a militia unit called the 15th Alberta Light Horse in Calgary and had served as a trooper for one summer of training and for a part of a winter at the local armories. Consequently, I had some military knowledge when I reached the university, which was unlike most of the students there, and therefore I was made a Lance Corporal immediately in the COTC.
How did the rigors of Army life suit you? What was your reaction to military read Army discipline?
Oh, fine. I was young, 19 years old, in good shape, and I found the rigors of Army life rather luxurious, in fact. They weren't too difficult at all. As far as the discipline was concerned, I accepted the discipline without any great deal of trouble, knowing that in order to be able to serve as an officer, I had to be able to accept discipline myself. And so it was really a state of mind. And I found no trouble with my whole Army career in either the rigors or the discipline of the forces.
While you were at the University of Alberta training with the COTC, were you supplied with proper uniforms and weaponry with which to train? I know at the beginning of the war, the Canadian forces had a terrible time trying to get proper battle dress and modern rifles and guns and whatnot. And I'm just wondering, during the training process,
By the time I got to university in the winter of 1941, there was no problem with uniforms. We were equipped properly with battle dress.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the only problem we had was with some of the more modern weapons. We had a shortage of what was known as the boys' anti-tank rifle. I remember seeing it, but never seeing it fired and never having had a chance to fire it.
Uh-huh.
And the same, I think, was true of our light machine gun. The Bren gun was in very, very short supply. I remember going and training on the ranges firing machine gun, but the machine gun I actually fired was the Lewis gun because we were short of Bren guns.
Which was an old British?
Which was an old, virtually a World War I light machine gun.
Would this have presented any problem, not necessarily for you personally, but for Canadian forces in general, once they actually saw active service in Europe, by not perhaps having the time or the experience with some of the newer weapons? Did it present any problems on the battlefield?
No, because this was only at the university COTC, remember. Later on, when I went to train as an active service officer, I then immediately got adequate training on the actual weapons that we were going to use.
Mm-hmm. By May 1942, I find this rather interesting, you were attached or posted to the Canadian Active Service Force. What was this unit exactly, and how was it that you became ultimately attached to it?
Well, it was actually the 7th of August, 42, as I look at my book here, that I was attached to the Officers Training Course, Western Canada, as a reinforcement officer. That is the present Gordon Head campus. Mm-hmm. And while I was at the university, I was offered an opportunity to take a reserve commission while I was there. Mm-hmm. In other words, it didn't involve me in going active, but it made me a commissioned officer in the University of Alberta COTC. And I applied for this particular one, knowing that I was still a little underage, and figuring that if I applied for active, I would get the same kind of treatment I got from the Navy and would be kicked out after a few weeks.
You were how old at this point, 17?
No, I was 19 in February 1942, and you had to be 19 and a half, really, to do anything. So I applied for the reserve commission. Unfortunately, the adjutant put it on the wrong list. And it was put on the active force commission. Well, since I planned to go active anyway, as soon as I was of age, I just never said anything about it and let the thing go through. And in due course, I was interviewed by Brigadier Harvey of MD-13 for this particular commission. Before I was interviewed, the adjutant actually came to me and said, "How in the hell did you get on this list? You're underage. You can't possibly go and have an interview with Brigadier Harvey. Go on back out and get on with your training. I'll scrub you from the list." But unfortunately for him anyways, the list went into Brigadier Harvey, and he saw my name on it. He said, "Where's McGregor?" And they explained that he was underage and that he'd been removed from the list. But Harvey noticed while he was reading the file that was in front of him, which had come in from the list, that I had been with the 15th Alberta Light Horse as a militiaman. Mm-hmm. And Harvey himself was a Strathcona horse, a cavalryman. And I think there was some kind of fondness for one cavalryman for another cavalryman. He said, "Well, come on, send McGregor in to me and I'll see him anyway." Mm-hmm. At that time I was in fatigue clothes and somebody rushed madly out to me and said, "The brigadier wants to see you." And I said, "Well, I'll have to change into my good uniform." He said, "No, don't do that. Come right away." So I was marched in my fatigue clothes, Brigadier Harvey, and he had a chat with me. And when it was all over, he said, "Well, McGregor, you're a little too young for this," he said, "but I'm going to take a risk on it. I'm going to put you through for an active force commission." Mm-hmm. And hence I went to the Gordon Head training in August.
As you just mentioned, you did come west to what is now UVic.
Yeah.
Would the training involved here be similar to that experience at COTC, or would this be more advanced?
Oh no, this is much more advanced. They had all the proper weapons, and we trained on all the weapons that an infantry officer was likely to see. And I think the training was excellent. It was a very compressed 3-month course. And it's difficult at this stage to visualize training an officer in 3 months. But nevertheless, we worked very hard. We worked 7 days a week and we worked at nights. And I think at the end of the 3-month course, we were reasonably well prepared. At least we were better trained than our men were.
What were, in general, what were the facilities or the amenities like here?
Well, they were first class. You've still got some of our old barrack buildings on the campus. That's where we slept. Mm-hmm. The standard army rations and kitchens, as far as I was ever concerned, these were also first class. Mm-hmm. The instructors, generally speaking, were a bit older. Some of them were World War I instructors. Mm-hmm. But I was very impressed with them. And some of them were senior NCOs who'd been brought back from overseas because of injury or illness or something of that nature and were instructing here. And altogether, I thought it was a first-class 3 months.
By, I guess, the end of August 1942, you had been graduated as a second lieutenant in the infantry and ultimately posted to CITC Canadian Infantry Training Corps in Calgary for what was termed advanced training. As you just said, what the training you experienced here was that much higher than under COTC. So I'm just wondering what advanced training in this sense would mean.
Well, the advanced training in Calgary, for the first time, exposes the command of men. While we're at the COTC, we had command, but only of each other, by taking turns being corporals and sergeants and whatever in the platoon. But at A16 CITC, we actually had infantry recruits that were under training, and we were given command of them for various activities. We would take them on the ranges, we would do training exercises with them, we would be posted to one of the rifle companies and understudy a regular officer who was doing it to act as a platoon 2IC and so on. Mm-hmm. So the advanced training really first exposes to the command of men.
Were you personally comfortable? Can you remember your first experience actually out on drill or parade commanding a group of men? Did you find it a comfortable experience?
Oh, I found it a comfortable experience. I was probably quite insufferable. I was sure that I was quite capable of commanding anything it could throw at me, and I had perhaps a surplus of confidence.
What would be, as an aside here, what would happen to somebody, let's say, in your position that was deemed unsuitable for the command? Would they be given a second chance, or would they be washed out?
Well, in some cases, they would be given a second chance, particularly if their failure to qualify was caused by illness or injury or something of that nature. But if they actually proved to be unsuitable, they would probably have been weeded out at the OTC and wouldn't reach the advanced training stage.
Wouldn't have got as far as counting.
Yeah.
In September, you were graduated as a lieutenant and immediately drafted to the United Kingdom as a reinforcement for the Canadian Infantry Corps, I believe at Thursday Common in Surrey.
Yes, 1CDIRU.
Right. What was or were your impressions upon reaching England with respect to the general situation there with the country more or less under siege, and you had gone essentially from a quote peacetime Canada to a wartime England where the war is right there? What were your impressions upon reaching England?
Well, England was by no means at war in November of 1942 when I reached there. The Blitz had finished. And it was just a fascinating country for a young man. It had all sorts of things Canada didn't have, pubs and country lanes and hedgerows and everything that one had heard about. Mm-hmm. It was interesting to be exposed to them, and I found it just a fascinating place.
How were the Canadians accepted by the local population and by the British forces themselves?
I always found they were accepted really as A, brothers, and B, guests. They were given the best of both worlds of being relatives and also honored guests, and we were treated royally by the British population.
Were the Canadians sort of thrust into the role, and you hear about this more in a contemporary sense, but were you sort of the middleman between the British and the American forces? Was there sort of trying to explain one to the other?
Well, this may have been the case in the higher echelons of the army, but certainly at the lower levels it didn't occur to us at all to try to explain each other. In fact, we felt ourselves part of the British army in those days, and if the Americans were looked upon as interlopers, they were looked upon as interlopers by Canadians and British. Mm-hmm. And so I don't ever recall any middleman activities on the part of the Canadians.
Soon after reaching England, you were sent as what was called a reinforcement officer to the Loyal Edmonton Regiment training company at Bull for more intensive training. In particular, what would that training involve?
Well, I wasn't sent to the Loyal Edmonton Regiment, and therein hangs a tale. When I left Calgary, of course, as a resident of Calgary, I intended to join the Calgary Highlanders, and I had purchased the badges and various things I would need for the Calgary Highlanders. But when I arrived overseas, in the middle of the night, by the time my part of the draft got off the ship in Gurrock, we were marched into a blackout railway station. And one of the RTOs, Railway Transportation Officers, seeing my badges and having a group of stray Canadians that he wanted sent off, grabbed hold of me and said, "Here, take these Canadians, here's your boarding pass and everything else," and put me on the wrong train. And instead of going to the 2nd Canadian Divisional Reinforcement Unit for the Calgary Highlanders, I got on the train for the 1st Divisional Reinforcement Unit and ended up with the nearest regiment to my home city, the Loyal Edmonton Regiment. So I actually, from there on, was ticketed eventually to go to the Loyal 11th Regiment. But when I went to Hope, I was still just a general reinforcement officer, and I took what is known as the Infantry Officer's Wireless Course and learned how to operate infantry signals equipment.
Mm-hmm. What, in general, what's the training methodology, if you will, in these areas, modeled upon essentially British tactics or British manuals?
Absolutely. We were using British manuals. They were published by the War Office. There were no such things as Canadian manuals in those days.
And that would hold, I assume, for just about every facet of military training?
Every facet of military training. In fact, we used all British equipment. We had no American equipment, as the Canadian Army does today, is largely American equipped. In those days, we were totally British equipped, dressed in virtually the same battle dress, although ours, being made in Canada, was of a slightly finer material, which sometimes caused a bit of jealousy. But you could tell a Canadian by looking at his battle dress.
During the training period, especially in England, was there an area of specialization of particular interest to yourself?
No, I was simply being qualified as quickly as possible in all the things that made an infantry officer useful. So. Mm-hmm. I took battle courses, and I took driving and maintenance courses, and I took a course in the 6-pounder anti-tank gun, and generally speaking, trained to become a more useful infantry officer.
That more or less brought me to my next question, because after Hove, you went to the 3rd Wing Canadian Training School in Camp Borden for what was called a chemical transport course. I guess more or less they made you a mechanic.
Yeah.
I guess the idea behind all these various things was just mold you into an all-around all-purpose officer, more or less.
Right. It was called a mechanical transport course, not chemical. And that was to enable me to perform the function of a transport officer in an infantry battalion, and expose me to the innards and the outards and the operating characteristics of the standard army vehicles in the infantry battalion.
Mm-hmm. As you just noted, there was no particular area of significant interest to you. How about reversing that? Was there any area there that you
No, I enjoyed all my training. It was first class, and there was one area, I might add, that it was of fair interest to me. I went on what was known as the Canadian Military Headquarters Battle Course at 5 Wing CTS, which was a battle drill course.
Mm-hmm.
And that taught infantry platoon and company tactics in drill form, so that they could be set into motion very quickly and very thoroughly in the middle of the confusion of action. The people knew how to act and where to go and what to do. And I enjoyed that course very much indeed. I was very fit and keen. I could run all day long without any trouble. So I passed out very high on that course. And then subsequently battle drills became one of my specialties. Even throughout my career became a specialty of mine.
I'm just wondering if you peeked at my question sheet here. That was my next question with respect to the 5th Wing CTS. That was mm-hmm. the spring 1943.
Yes.
I was going to ask you what this period was like for you. You just answered that, I think, fairly well. Did you get a feeling, though, once you were assigned to the 5th Wing CTS, and as you say, training in battle drill, did you get the feeling that perhaps an active duty posting was imminent or around the corner?
Well, I thought so, but I was posted instead to what was called the CRU Battle School at a place called Cookham Crossroads outside of Aldershot.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed at that particular battle school
9 months,
for about 9 months, from the 28th of April 1943 to the 23rd of October 1943, as an instructor in battle drill.
So that was a surprise for you, a little bit?
That was a surprise. I was delighted to have been selected at first. I took it as a compliment, and it was fine. After two or three courses, each of which was a month long, I began to think, well, I better get out of here. And after about 4 courses, I started agitating to get out, and I didn't manage to get out until I'd been there for about 6 months.
What is the role of an instructor? Did you find this, as a soldier, was this a professionally satisfying role for you?
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. very much so, particularly in battle drills, because one had the opportunity to see somebody come in who was uncertain of himself and who didn't really know what tactics were at the lower levels of an infantry battalion, and after a month's course where he was drilled in how to do these things and drilled into what to say and drilled in how to give orders, he became a very confident and competent individual under all sorts of pressures, bursting thunder flashes and battle noises and smoke and tear gas, chemical grenades, everything of that nature that were designed to throw him off his stride. By the end of a course, he was able to concentrate through this kind of distraction and still command a platoon quite competently. And it was always great satisfaction to see these people come in one way and go out as really good young infantry officers.
It's also almost a matter of pride in that you could train somebody to react in that fashion.
Exactly, and I was still insufferable at that stage of the game. I was sure I could do everything better than anyone else, and I was delighted to improve them with my expertise.
By the same token, with an individual, let's say, that didn't respond as well as you might hope, did you find that almost as a personal downfall? Did you blame yourself for that?
No, not at all. Occasionally somebody was selected for the course who was ill-suited for the course. He should have remained in a base job or something. He was physically unfit or something of that nature. But as long as the chap kept trying to the limit of his ability, we were delighted to work with him. Mm-hmm. And we had very few who sort of gave up and became sullen and didn't try to do, which was a really very difficult, physically strenuous course.
Mm-hmm. Did you, while an instructor at the 1st Division Battle School, did you encounter any particular obstacles or difficulties in instructing a large body of men who were obviously by this time pretty eager for battle, I imagine?
No, I don't think. The only difficulty I can recall is we were issued with a standard Smith & Wesson 38 pistol, 38 caliber pistol. All officers were issued with it. And they were short of ammunition for the 38, so I issued with 12 rounds of 38 ammunition and told to keep them, not to use them. I found out that the much more readily available 9mm ammunition, which was used in our submachine guns, would actually fit inside a 38 Smith & Wesson pistol and could be fired from it. And this worked fine. I used my pistol and fired 9mm ammunition through a 38 pistol for quite a long time until one day I fired it. There was a dull sort of noise out of it, and I found that I had a pistol with the tip of a 38mm round sticking out of the bottom, and I had considerable difficulty in explaining it to the Court of Inquiry, which was summoned to find out why I had destroyed a service pistol.
By January 1944, you've been posted to the 1st Division, what is termed holding unit, in Italy. I'm just curious what exactly a holding unit, would that be a unit on the verge of being thrust into the active duty, or what exactly was a holding unit?
Well, a holding unit was just exactly what it says. It held reinforcements that were in the stream on the way up to their various battalions to replace the casualties. Mm-hmm. And your stay in the holding unit depended upon the casualties your unit or your division had and how quickly you were sent up to them. Mm-hmm. And while you were in the holding unit, you trained very hard. There were all ranks in the holding unit. They were formed into platoons for training, and we went on exercises and crashed through the mountains and hills and vineyards and olive groves of Italy, and worked very hard until our time came to be called up to our unit to replace some casualty.
Mm-hmm. In May, you reported again to the Lower Leventon Regiment, and on the 21st of that month, by this time as a platoon CO, you participated in an action against what became known as the Hitler Line, and I was wondering, is for the layperson, could you describe exactly what the Hitler Line was?
Yes, the Hitler Line was a rather important battle for my regiment. The 2nd Brigade was bogged down in the Hitler Line, which was basically a German defensive position with dug-in tank turrets, dug-in machine guns, vast masses of barbed wire, and minefields protecting all of them, and it was a very tough nut to crack. My first job at the Loyal Element Regiment was as second in command of the anti-tank platoon. I wasn't immediately sent to an infantry platoon. And that particular day I remember trying to help get the anti-tank guns up. But because the forward rifle companies did not penetrate the line and were bogged down in the minefields and wire and had been cut down pretty badly by machine gun fire and tank gun fire, they couldn't get any farther forward, so I couldn't get the guns any farther forward. And I sat in rather behind the rifle companies waiting for a chance to go forward and watched what was happening. I was under, everybody in the area was under very heavy defensive shell fire from the enemy. And altogether, it was a very noisy and unpleasant day. And since it was my first battle, I thought, well, that's exactly what battle is like, and it's what I anticipated it would be. It's somewhat like the training I took to go into it. And I was quite satisfied with the day. And it wasn't until about 8 months later, when I had considerable battle experience, that I looked back and I realized that the Hitler line was probably one of the worst battles that my regiment fought during the war. They took more casualties and had were under much more enemy fire during 24 hours than they ever were again during the rest of the war.
Were you facing by that time, was that primarily German troops, or were there a fair number of Italians still involved?
There were Italians involved in the theater, but we were facing at that particular time only German troops.
How, I was just curious, how did the indigenous Italian civilian population react to the presence of the Canadians and the Allies? Was there, were they beginning to make overtures towards sort of coming over, or were they still more or less in the middle there?
Well, as far as I can make out, the Italian country people that we met were rather reluctant participants in the war. And their chief reaction to the Canadians, who were always scrounging for eggs and chickens and various things like that to improve their somewhat uninteresting rations, was to wring their hands and say, niente uova, niente galline, tedeschi portare tutte via, which means no eggs, no chickens, the German has taken them all away.
Did you or any units that you're aware of, did they have much problem with, this is probably the wrong term, but Italian partisans, people that would be working for the Germans in terms of sabotage?
No, we had nothing to do with them at all. Late in the Italian campaign, just in fact before we were ready to leave Italy, we did work for a short while beside an Italian combat group called the Cremona Combat Group, made up of Italian soldiers who'd come over to the Italian or to the Allied side and were fighting side by side with us. I must say that in general we were rather contemptuous of them, and in retrospect that may be unfair because they were reassembled from a vast variety of units. They hadn't really trained well together. Their morale and cohesion was poor. One couldn't really expect them to behave like the well-trained Canadians behaved, and they didn't behave like the well-trained Canadians.
With respect to a unit such as this, I would imagine trust would be an awfully hard thing for them to get from the Canadians or the Americans, due to the fact that they had, in essence, switched sides. Were you ever worried that they would switch again?
No, we're never worried about it. I'm not sure where it came from, but we were generally speaking contemptuous of the Italians, the population. Not so much the population, who were pretty innocent people anyways. The ones that we came across were farmers and countrymen. But we were contemptuous of their forces. We called them spaghetti leaguers. And I don't think I never heard of anybody having any worry about the Italians. We rather hoped that if we came up against the enemy first, that they would be Turkmen or alien German divisions. And failing that, that they would be Italian divisions. We expected our battles to be easy if we came up against Italians or Turkmen.
Were they generally easy when you did run into
it? We never fought against the Italians. We did fight against the Turkmen division, and we took vast numbers of prisoners. I had a bet on with the intelligence officer who had taught me how to play poker, that he said that I owed him 2,700 lira. He said he would give me 100 lira for every prisoner I sent him. The day we went into battle in Fortunato Ridge against the Turkmen division, I took 54 prisoners and sent them back. And I said, that's okay, only 50 lira each will do, and cancel my poker debt.
You stayed with the platoon.
13th platoon of Charlie Company.
Until November 1944, when you were posted to junior NCO school with the 1st Division, and I'm sorry, I will probably swallow the pronunciation, but I think it's Riccioni.
Riccioni.
Riccioni, in Italy. Again, as an instructor for a month. I'm just wondering, at that point, were you a little disappointed or relieved to be pulled out of an active zone into a situation like that?
No.
Would you rather have been with the boys in the unit?
No, it was almost a turn and turnabout sort of thing. I had been with the unit steadily and had never been what they call LOB, left out of battle. This was the process by which the Canadians always left out the second in command of a rifle company or the second in command of a platoon, a group of people who were left out of battle so that if the unit was badly damaged in battle or decimated, they would have a nucleus on which to reorganize with reinforcements coming up. Well, I'd never had a chance to be LOB, and suddenly somebody in the unit orderly room said, well, McGregor's never been LOB, and here's a chance to go for a month to the junior NCO school. We have to send somebody, some lieutenant, so let's send McGregor. And I went to the junior NCO school at Riccione-Sur-Mare, and I remember very little about teaching junior NCOs, but I presume we taught junior NCOs.
And you did a reasonably good job.
I do remember one thing. I remember that the commanding officer of the school was a chap named Gentleman Jim Ritchie, who was a regular force soldier from the Royal Canadian Regiment, and he was rather a tough character. I remember him just before Christmas calling me in and saying, we need more booze for the mess for Christmas, go get some. So I went back down the line to Ancona, which is the nearest civilian city which had been reestablished, went into the town major's office and found the town major was absent. His Italian assistant or clerk was reluctant to release any of the stored liquors that they had until he could get an authority. So I signed an authority for him with a forged signature of Santa Claus and took the stuff back to the officer's mess at the Riccione Junior NCO School.
As we just mentioned, you were at the school for approximately 1 month, then back again to the Italian Rifle Company, whereupon you engaged in the remaining battles, which culminated where for you? What was the last
battle? Well, the last battle we had was the approach to the Senio River, and that's virtually where we ended the war, which was a substantial river, which had been flooded, had very high dike banks, and the Germans were dug in on one side of the dike, on one side of the river on the dike banks, and we were on the other side of the river on the other side of the dike bank. Mm-hmm. And we sat there for a while and held the line until we left the theater.
I might
just add that in the we had some very interesting battles in the approach, final approaches to the Senio River. I guess one of the more interesting ones to me was the Naviglio Canal battle. I went started off as a platoon commander, and my company commander was wounded on his way back from an orders group. He very gallantly managed to stagger back to the company headquarters and pass on the orders he'd received from battalion, and I took over the command of the company. And so I had the opportunity of commanding a company for the next 3 or 4 weeks in action, in fact, really for the remainder of the war as a lieutenant. And I enjoyed that very much indeed. That gave me a wider scope with three platoons rather than three sections.
Mm-hmm. And the challenge of the responsibility, you didn't intimidate you at all. You were pretty gung-ho.
Well, again, I was pretty insufferable. I was quite convinced that I knew how to command the company better than anybody I'd ever seen command a company before, and I was rather relieved at the opportunity to be able to do so. It wasn't so much a challenge as a feeling of, well, I've got this thing in charge, things will go my way for a change, and we'll see what we can do.
So you